Here, okay. So last week in lesson 144, we concluded our study of the Bishop's Bible. Currently, there is only one pre-1611 English Bible left to discuss before we begin looking at the King James Bible this fall, and it's the 1582 Reims New Testament. So my intention, guys, is to finish this conversation of the Reims in May, and then we're going to take our customary summer break from doing this in June, July, and August, which will allow me time to read ahead and study in advance for what we're going to be doing. And I'm going to be looking for some folks, I'm going to be looking for some men to hopefully be able to have some classes during the summer, like we normally do. So not to mention any names, but there are a couple of you in here that I would like to possibly consider that. If you would do that, I'm going to have a calendar next week, blank calendar for the summer, and we'll start kind of taking names. We'll kind of leave it open to whatever assignment somebody wants to do on their own instead of me assigning things, and we'll see what kind of feedback we get from that. But anyway, we're going to finish the discussion of the Reims today and then into next month. When we're done discussing the Reims, then we're going to stop for the summer and then restart again in September the way we normally do, okay? So that's kind of the way where things are going. And it's kind of working out nice. We can just kind of finish this and then we'll have a nice starting point for where we begin again in September, okay? So, next point. Despite the claims of the prevailing two streams of Bible's orthodoxy in the King James only movement, the Reims New Testament did contribute to the King James Bible. Now, I mentioned this to you briefly last time. Consequently, we need to understand its origin, aims, and contribution to the King James. So this is an inconvenient fact, okay, that the Reims New Testament does contribute to the King James Bible. The Reims New Testament is not mentioned in the list of, in the rules of the, that we're going to govern the King James Bible translation. We know that rule number one was to follow the Bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original said otherwise. And then rule 14, there was a listing of other Bibles that they should consider if they felt like the Bishop's was not as it should be. The Reims is not listed in rule 14, but it did impact the translation. Okay, and there are Reimish words and readings in a King James Bible that we will be talking about here in the coming weeks. Somebody, last Sunday, when I mentioned this at the end of the hour, right as we were closing up, a gentleman went into the live chat comments and put in a statement about John Boyce. John Boyce was the gentleman who took notes on the final review of the King James Bible, and his notes are one of the three primary documents that have survived history that have come down to us. I have a copy of John Boyce's notes, so I went and I read them this week. And yes, Boyce mentions the Reims Bible in his notes. So there is no doubt about the fact that the Reims translation did have an influence on what happened between 1604 and 1611 in the production of the King James. Now, this is an inconvenient fact because the Reims Bible is considered to be, and we'll talk more about this here in the introduction here shortly, it's considered to be a corrupt Bible because of the two streams of Bible's paradigm or understanding of transmission slash preservation. So let me just be clear with you about something. I don't bring up these things to be purposefully controversial. Okay? I bring these things up because we need to have a good factual understanding of what happened. It, in my opinion, it does us no good at all to say things, however well-intended, in defense of the King James that are not true. Okay? I don't think that helps us at all. And in fact, I think it hurts us. And it should be something that we should seek to avoid. And if we discover that things that have been said are not necessarily accurate, I think we should rethink. We don't have to rethink our position on the King James and say, well, lay aside the King James and pick up a modern version. That's not what I'm advocating for. What I'm advocating for is that in our defense and our understanding of the King James, that we don't say things that aren't true. Okay? So let's look at the next point. In lessons 87 through 92, we studied the veracity of the popular two streams of Bibles model of transmission. In doing so, we noted the placement of the Latin Vulgate and the Reims New Testament in the corrupt stream slash tree of transmission, while the Old Latin and Wycliffe versions were placed in the stream slash, should say, in the pure stream slash tree. Okay? So I'm going to go down. I want you guys to turn to the back of your notes and just remind yourself of this in Appendix A. I'm going to scroll down here in the digital copy of the notes so that people can see what I'm talking about. So we understand that the idea of two streams first originated with the Seventh-day Adventist teacher Benjamin Wilkinson, right? And then it was picked up and moved forward by J.J. Ray. So in Appendix A, we have the two trees illustrations of J.J. Ray and Peter Ruckman. Now, we've already seen this, all right? But I want to point out a couple things to you here. So this is the stream or the tree of textual corruption. So notice a couple things here, okay? So textual corruption, Sinaiticus, Vaticanus. Then notice he's got Jerome's Vulgate there in 382, right? And then you go up this, and you see it's got the Douay of 1582 here on the left side. That's the Reims, sometimes referred to as the Douay Reims. And the reason it's sometimes referred to as the Douay Reims is because the New, and as we'll see in a little bit when we go through the notes, the New Testament was published in 1582, and the Old Testament was published in like 1610. The New Testament was published in Reims, France. The Old Testament was published in Douay, France. And so it becomes known as the Douay Reims, which would have been the complete Bible here, okay? But notice that he's got the, where is the Douay Bible here in this stream of, in this tree of corruption? It's in the same tree with the Latin Vulgate and with Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Vaticanus, and the Westcott and Hort text and the modern versions that came from that text. Okay, does everybody see that? Okay, let's go to the next page. So here's Ruckman, his tree of corruption. And you can see that he also has Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. He's got Jerome's Vulgate here in 382. And then if you go up, he also has, where did it go? He's got the Vulgate from 1592, and he's got the Douay Bible also from 1582, and these are in the stream of what? Or the tree, the stream of corruption here, okay? And then if we go to the other side of this, which would be the pure stream or the pure tree, notice that we have Wycliffe's Bible from 1382. Here's the problem with that. What did Wycliffe translate? Anybody remember? We talked about this. Wycliffe is not translating the Greek. He's translating the Latin Vulgate. But the Latin Vulgate was just on the previous slide. It was on the corrupt what? The corrupt tree. So if Wycliffe's Bible is coming from the Latin Vulgate and the Latin Vulgate is corrupt, then how is it exactly that Wycliffe's is wholly pure when it's coming from the Latin Vulgate? Okay, you guys following this, okay? So you, but yet, the Reims, which is also a translation of the Vulgate, is in the corrupt tree, or the corrupt stream, when Wycliffe's is here, right? So there are basic factual things about this understanding of transmission slash preservation that just, there are major problems with them, okay? So if you look at the last sentence there in that, if you go back to page one, so there are many factual problems with doing this, right? So you can't say that the Latin Vulgate is corrupt and place the Reims Bible in the corrupt stream or on the corrupt tree and then turn around and put the Wycliffe Bible on the pure tree when they both came from the same one. When they both came from the same source. It's inconsistent and it's not accurate. All right? Now, before we move on, anybody have any questions about that?
The Vulgate wasn't Wycliffe's only source, though, right? I mean, he used other...
It's my understanding that he did not use Greek at all.
But he used...
He would have used Anglo-Saxon, he would have used some other things that were there, but the basis of his translation would have been the Latin Vulgate.
Okay.
Okay? Now, and it's interesting, Mike, you bring that up, because one of the things I'm going to do is we're going to look at least one passage in parallel columns that shows Wycliffe and Reams. And you'll see very clearly that they are almost the same. They're very, very similar to each other in the way they read in a host of different passages. And the reason for it is because they're both translations out of Latin. So if you're translating out of Latin, is it going to leave hallmark marks on what you're, on the translation that it came from Latin and not from Greek? Okay? Now, so let's go back to page one. So, any questions about why the dichotomous nature of the two streams is sort of not a very accurate way to think about things? Beyond the fact that I've already spent like 7 hours talking to you about this 2 years ago in 2019. Okay, so I understand that those of you who are either watching us now for the first time or are going to watch this after the fact and maybe didn't get the information, you absolutely need to go back and look at lessons 87 through 92 to get sort of the precursory information for why I'm saying what I'm saying. For now, understand that the Reims is viewed as wholly corrupt, as well as the Latin Vulgate, according to this two streams, two trees way of thinking, yet the Wycliffe Bible is viewed as wholly pure. This is inconsistent because they're both coming from the same one, the same source. Okay, so let's go to the next point. Moreover, in lesson 89, we noted that the Catholic Reims New Testament of 1582 is always placed in the stream of corrupt Bibles, along with modern versions such as the NIV and New American Standard, the ESV, and the New King James. The following portion of a meme is very popular on Facebook and several other social media websites. Okay, so all of these verses, so almost all modern versions, including the NIV, remove 16 entire verses from the New Testament. So if you are looking at an NIV and you're in Matthew 17, you will read verse 20, it'll skip to verse 22, and there will be a footnote, and at the bottom of the page it'll say that this verse, Matthew 17, 21, is not in the oldest and best, and blah, 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 and they just leave it out of the text. Okay? Same thing with all 16 of these verses. Now those of you that are familiar with this, you've seen these things before. We've talked about these things many, many times in the past here in this church, as we've talked about why the Bible version issue matters, right? Now, so let's go to the next page. So I downloaded a PDF copy of the original Reams. Here it is, okay? So this is a PDF facsimile of the original 1582 Reams New Testament. This is the title page. We'll be talking more about this here in a minute, okay? But I've downloaded this, and I downloaded it with the intention of checking to see if these 16 verses were in the Reims New Testament. Okay? Is everybody following me so far? Mm-hmm. Okay? So we don't have time to look up every single one of these, so you're going to have to just take my word for it, and if you want, I'll send you the PDF and you can look yourself. But all 16 of these references that are missing from an NIV and an ESV, all 16 of those verses are in this Reims New Testament. All 16 of them. Okay? In addition, the Reims New Testament includes the long ending of Mark. Mark 16 verses 9 through 20. It includes the woman taken in adultery at the end of John chapter 7, beginning of John chapter 8. All verses that are thrown into question by modern scholarship and modern textual criticism and are questioned in new Bibles as to their authenticity, okay? So the Reims is not doing any of that, right? Now here's my point. Is it right to say then that the Reims is in the corrupt stream along with the NIV and the ESV when the Reims has these verses in it? You following what I'm saying? Okay? So let's go back to the notes. I downloaded a PDF copy of the original Reims New Testament and checked to see if the 16 verses listed on the meme above were omitted. My investigation revealed that all 16 verses that are missing from modern versions are present in the Reims New Testament of 1582. Textually, now this is an important statement, textually one would be better off reading a Reims New Testament than they would be reading a modern version. Now, why would I say that? Because the verses that are missing from the NIV, are they all in the Reams?
Yeah.
Now, do not misunderstand me. That is not a across-the-board blanket advocacy on my part for the Reams. There are other problems with the Reams, but they're not coming from the actual text. They're coming from the fact that the footnotes and the endnotes and all this stuff are thoroughly Roman Catholic in the way they're explaining things. But the text, the verses that are included in the biblical text, the 16 verses as well as the two other passages I just mentioned, they are all in this Reams New Testament that are missing or questioned in a modern version. Okay? So, any questions about that? So some people are going to hear that and they're going to like lose their mind because they think I'm saying something I'm not saying. So let me say it again. I am not saying that you should pick up a Reams New Testament and read it as your primary Bible. What I am saying is that if you were living on an island somewhere and somebody came to you and they gave you a choice between an NIV and a Reams, as far as the text, you'd be better off picking what?
Reams.
The Reams. Which is totally contrary to the two trees and the two streams thing that I just showed you. Okay? So, the influence, next point, the influence of the Reams New Testament upon the King James Bible is a textual and historical reality. Recently, Dr. Lawrence M. Vance released Chapter 4, the Reams New Testament and the Authorized Version, from his forthcoming book, The Text of the King James Bible. The documentation provided therein, as well as the notes of John Boyce, make it abundantly clear that the Reams New Testament influenced the King James translators. Okay? So, Lawrence M. Vance, he's in a 10-year project of writing a book called The Text of the King James Bible. He offered to, you could purchase each chapter in subscription form as it was finished. And he would release it in a spiral binding. So I signed up for that and I purchased it. And then when he's done, he'll send you a bound copy of the, you know, the complete book. So I just got this chapter like 3 weeks ago, right before we were getting ready to talk about this. So the timing couldn't have been more perfect. And he is very clear, and we will go through what he says about it and show you the documentation of where the King James is following or reading similarly to the Reams in certain verses. Okay? So, suffice it to say that there are many misconceptions among King James advocates when it comes to the Reams New Testament. Therefore, the matter is deserving of careful study and consideration. We will begin our study of this controversial Bible with a consideration of the following points. So today, if we have time to get through both points, we're going to look at Queen Elizabeth, Catholicism, and the Bible. And then we're going to look at the Reams New Testament, what saith the preface. So if you want to understand what they were after and what they were trying to accomplish, you need to read the preface of the Reams New Testament where they explain what's going on. Okay? So those are the two points that we're going to try to consider here. Now, before we get into it too far, does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay. So, Queen Elizabeth, Catholicism, and the Bible. Point one. In Lesson 138, we considered the Elizabethan context that gave rise to the Bishop's Bible. That same context impacted English Catholics and eventually gave rise to the Catholic Reams New Testament in 1582. Charles C. Butterworth reminds us of this context in his 1941 book, The Literary Lineage of the King James, 1340-1611. He says, quote, "The great word in her," referring to Elizabeth, "religious policy was uniformity, which meant, of course, conformity with the established worship of the Church of England. As her reign went on, there was more and more opposition to this conformity. By adopting a middle position between the demands of Catholics and those of the Puritans, the Queen found that her religious policy was being opposed by both parties. The Puritans thought that the church had not gone far enough along the pathway of reform, and the Catholics felt that it had gone entirely too far. Okay? Which shouldn't shock you, right? It was with the latter group that Elizabeth had her biggest struggle. So this would be the Catholics. Inasmuch as her religious conflict was intensified by what she regarded as a dangerous and threatening alliance between the Pope and the King of Spain. Okay? So what ends up happening is a political alliance between the papacy and the King of Spain. So just think about this for a second, okay? If you think about North and South America, everything from Mexico south was essentially colonized by who? The Spanish, right? So they brought the Spanish language, they brought Jesuit priests and monks were embedded in every Spanish expedition that came to the New World. And the purpose was to convert the native people to Catholicism, right? So that is why to this day in the New World, everything from Mexico south, primarily except with the exception of Brazil, which is Portuguese, speaks Spanish and is predominantly Roman Catholic. That's a fact, right? Okay. Because, and it goes back to what was going on here with these issues. Somebody at the door. So, That's the reality that exists now, largely because of this, right? So the Pope had a political alliance with the King of Spain at this time. So Elizabeth, Lisa, there's a set of notes on the back if you're interested in grabbing them. So the Pope, it has this alliance with the King of Spain. This is going to be politically threatening to Elizabeth. She is going to take this as a threat to her power and to the, you know, autonomy of the English nation, right? She is worried, in other words, that this alliance between the Pope and the Spanish are going to threaten the independence of the British and that they're going to try to take over, right? And in fact, did they try this? You might have heard of it, the Spanish Armada, right? So there is a naval war between the British and the Spanish. And the British defeat the Spanish Armada, thereby ending any Popish Spanish threat to England. But there was a time before that where there was a lot of worry in the English government about the fact that the Spanish might try something. Okay? Bottom of page 2. Following the Council of Trent and the establishment of the Jesuit order, the activities of the Catholic Counter-Reformation were impacting Protestant enclaves in continental Europe. These trends, along with those being excommunicated by the Pope in 1570, prompted Queen Elizabeth to strengthen her stand against Catholicism in England. So the Pope excommunicates the English Queen in 1570, which is kind of funny because she really was never part of his church in the first place, but we won't trifle about details, okay? Look at page 3. In 1570, the Pope had excommunicated Elizabeth. And in the decade that followed, there was a definite resurgence of Catholic faith and influence over a large part of Europe, fomented by the zeal of the Jesuits. As this counter-reformation spread into Germany, France, and the Netherlands, Elizabeth stiffened her stand. Soon, every active emissary of Catholicism in England was suspected of plotting against the welfare of her realm. Conspiracies were unearthed and religious persecution started up again. The more prominent Catholics were compelled to depart from England, and over a period of years, a large number of them were put to death. So here we see almost the opposite of what we saw with Bloody Mary, right? Bloody Mary comes to the throne and she's going to persecute and execute Protestants. These plots against Elizabeth are unearthed. And so there's going to now be a period of persecution against Roman Catholics in England, which is going to prompt some of those English Catholics to flee, just like the Protestants had done prior. Okay? Everybody with me so far? At the same time, it was becoming increasingly clear to English Catholics that they needed their own English translation to compete with the deluge of Protestant Bibles being printed during Elizabeth's reign. Dr. Donald L. Brake summarizes this piece of the puzzle as follows in A Visual History of the English Bible. He says, quote, "The uneducated Roman Catholic saw no need for an English Bible since it was not self-explanatory. Yet the barrage of Protestant translations in the period of free expression of thought under Edward's reign began to have an effect on the Catholic Church. The production of the Geneva Bible in 1560 with sectarian theological notes set the stage for a Catholic translation with its own doctrines explained in extensive footnotes and marginal notes. So let's stop there. That's why I'm saying to you that I do not wholly endorse the Reims, because the explanatory notes are Roman Catholic in their explanation of doctrine. But that's not any different than what I said about the Geneva Bible. I could not wholly endorse the Geneva Bible because of the Calvinistic notes in the Geneva Bible that I didn't agree with, right? So when I said the comments at the beginning of the lesson in the introduction about the Reims, that you'd be better off reading a Reims than you would be an NIV, it was related to the biblical text presented in the Reims, having the verses in it that are left out of an NIV or an ESV. That's what I was meaning to say. And I think you all understand that, but I'm clarifying it again, lest somebody send me an email and try to accuse me of saying something I didn't say. Okay? Now, finally, so let's back up. So are there trends happening now that are leading the Roman Catholic Church to start to think, you know what, we better make our own Bible? Are they getting totally obliterated by the English Bible, particularly the Geneva Bible? So finally, so next paragraph, finally a justification for a vernacular Bible had surfaced. While a translation of the Bible alone was a threat to the church's authority, a Bible with a full interpretation expressing Catholic doctrines with full church authority behind it proved to be the impetus necessary for its approval. Now think about this. For over 200 years at this point had the Catholic Church banned and fought hard against a vernacular Bible in English. Yes. Now all of a sudden they're switching they do like a 180. Right? The only reason they're comfortable doing a 180 is because this Bible is going to present the notations, the marginal notes are going to present Catholic doctrine, and they're going to be done from the authorized Catholic source. And so therefore they're going to be okay with it, although they don't really want to do it. And you'll see that when we look at the preface. Okay. So the Roman Catholic Church had to act in self-defense, really. The Reformers' emphasis on Greek and Hebrew as the source for the English Bible, with some disdain, the Catholic changing Latin Vulgate, also helped to make the decision to commence a Catholic translation. As with the Protestant Bible under Henry VIII, the Douay Reims was a product of exiles fleeing persecution, this time from Protestant Elizabeth. Of course, the Latin Vulgate would be used, but if it was to be sanctioned, which Vulgate would be officially recognized? In 1547 at the Council of Trent, the Louvonian, I think is how you say that? Louvain edition of the Vulgate became the official authorized Bible of the Roman Catholic Church. It soon became imperative that an English translation be made with church sanctioned notes based upon the recently approved Louvain text. So, these English Catholic exiles found refuge in Douay, France. And it was during their sojourn in France that this group of Catholic exiles elected to produce an English Bible based upon the Latin text, should say authorized by the Council of Trent. Okay, so we'll get this quote and then we'll see if anyone has a question. The exiles found a refuge in France, especially in the town of Douay, where Philip II of Spain had founded a university. Here, William Allen, an Englishman, later elected as cardinal, was instrumental in establishing a college for the training of English priests, and thither quite a few of the Catholic exiles gathered. In 1578, an account of the disturbances with local authorities, the college was obligated to transfer its activity to the city of Reims. And it was here that a few of the most learned scholars of the college undertook the translation of the Bible into English for the use of Catholic readers. Okay? So, any questions about that point? Yeah?
Were the Catholics encouraged to Bible study on their own, or were they just told what the priest wanted them to hear?
So, it's a great question. I think that question will be answered when we look at what the preface said. Okay, so the long and the short of it is, they're doing this extremely grudgingly, and they don't really want to be doing it. It's very obvious to me when you read the preface to this thing that they are brought to this table literally kicking and screaming because they don't have no choice. Okay, and I think you'll see that, Bart, as we go on. Now, looking at the time, I'm not sure we'll have time to get through all of this, but we'll see how it goes. So any other questions about the first point? All right, so next point is the Reims New Testament, what saith the preface? So if you look up here at the screen here, this is the title page to the Reims New Testament. And then there is a lengthy preface that starts on the third page. So the preface to the reader, treating of these three points, and they spell out what the three points are. We'll talk more about this in a second. But this is like 30 some odd pages long, explaining why they're doing all this stuff. It's a slug, man, trying to read all through all this stuff. It's written in a very sort of Latin form. The sentences are totally long. It's hard to follow, but you know, we'll do the best we can with the way that I've chosen to break this down. But I am going to go back to the title page because we're going to end up talking about this first. Okay. So, point number one. Four men are generally credited with the creation of the Reims New Testament: William Allen, Richard Bristow, William Reynolds, and Gregory Martin. That Gregory Martin was the primary mover and shaker of the project, it's agreed upon by all historians. Quote, "The bulk of the work was performed by Gregory Martin, a former scholar at Oxford, a skillful conversationalist. For nearly 4 years, he worked regularly at his task with the assistance of Allen and one or two others. And in 1582, the New Testament was ready for publication." So Martin is the primary guy. Just like Matthew Parker was the primary guy for the Bishop's Bible, this guy Martin is the primary guy for the Reims New Testament. Okay? So the plan and purpose for the Reims New Testament is clearly set forth in its lengthy title on the title page. Please note that I've updated the spelling for ease of reading. And that would apply to any of these quotes from either the title page or from the preface. I just updated the spelling so that they were easier for you to read. But we're talking about this section right here. Okay, so let's read what that says from the notes. "The New Testament of Jesus Christ, translated faithfully into English out of the authentical Latin." It's an important statement. They are using the Latin that has been authorized by the Council of Trent, a Roman Catholic Church council. Okay? "According to the best corrected copies of the same, diligently conferred with the Greek and other editions in diverse languages, with arguments of books and chapters, annotations, and other necessary helps for better understanding of the text, and especially for the discovery of the corruption of diverse late translations, and for clearing the controversies in religion of these days. And the English College of Reims, printed at Reims by John Foggy, 1582, cum privilegio." Okay? So why are they doing this? To correct all the mistakes in the Protestant Bibles, and to settle what? The controversies in religion of these days. So, again, do they view this as almost a necessary thing that they don't really want to be doing, but they're going to do it because they feel like they have to? Okay? Everybody with me so far? So that quote right there is all that this says right here. So there's the printed at Reims, John Foggy, cum privilegio. So again, this is an early form of a copyright. Anybody could not just print this. Okay? But that's getting off topic a little bit, so I'm not going to go there. Then there's all this stuff here. There's some verses here. There's a quote from St. Augustine on the title page. We're just going to skip over that stuff for now because I don't think it's terribly helpful to what we're trying to do. So let's go back to the notes. "Regarding this lengthy title, Butterworth states the following. He says, quote, from this title, so that's what we just read, and that's what's at the top of the page right here, okay? From this title, we learn that the Douay Bible, as it is now known, of which the Reims New Testament was the portion first published, was designed to counteract the influence of the Geneva and Bishop's Bibles, and to give English Catholics a version approved by their own church. After the custom of this church, the translation was based on the Latin of the Vulgate Bible instead of on Greek and Hebrew. Yet it was a scholarly work and was, as the title said, diligently conferred with the original text. So they do a little bit of that, and we'll sort of be talking about the extent to which that happened as we go forward. So this is why, again, is this a thoroughly Catholic Bible in terms of the marginal notes and the helps that are in there and at the bottom of the page? Now, I will show you just something else just briefly here, assuming I can get to it relatively quickly. I want to show you how the text, all this is preface. As I said, the preface is like 30 some odd pages long. And it's like the most thrilling thing you've ever read in your life. Not really. Here you have the breakdown of the books, and then we get to the biblical text eventually here. The sum of the New Testament. Alright, so you see this here, it says the argument of St. Matthew's Gospel. So this is like their pre-notes. So if you have a Scofield Bible, you go open up to the book of Matthew, at the top there'll be like some background information about the book of Matthew. So this is their background information that they're providing for the book of Matthew. So here's Matthew. So you can see you've got the main text here in the center, and then you've got cross references on the left, and then you have notes here. And then at the bottom of at the end of every chapter, you have this massive section of annotations on the chapter. So annotations on chapter 1, and then they list all of their things that are listed out here, right? So for example, they comment on the virgin birth. And they talk in here about the perpetual virginity of Mary in this statement, right? Well, would you expect that from Roman Catholics in a Bible that they produce? Yes. So that's why I'm saying to you, I do not endorse the Reims New Testament. I'm saying to you, though, that the text of it is not as bad as even if you were to pick up an NIV. Does that make sense? Okay. So, bottom of page 4. Blackford Condit notes the shrewd nature of the preface of the Reims New Testament, top of page 5. The preface of the Reims New Testament is a shrewd document. Its design was to validate, quote, the wisdom and moderation of the Holy Church, both in withholding and permitting the vernacular scriptures. So, no matter what they do, are they wise? When they were forbidding the vernacular Bible, were they wise in doing that at the time? Yeah, when they are now allowing the English Bible and sanctioning an English Bible, are they also wise in doing that at the time? So, I mean, the Catholic Church, I mean, they just never do anything wrong, do they? I'm joking. Some of you thought I was serious. I don't think you did, actually, but, you know, somebody might, so I just have to be clear. All right, I want to find this preface here. Okay, that's where I want to be. So, J.I. Mombert states the following regarding the aims and purpose of the Reims preface in his 1883 work, English Versions of the Bible. He says, quote, this preface is quite lengthy, as I already mentioned, is a document of consummate skill and ingenious special pleading. It makes no reference to the use of the earlier English translations and contemporary versions, to which the translators of this version were under very great obligation, as we will show hereafter. So here's a dirty little secret about the Reims. They want to make out like they just used the Latin Vulgate. But when you actually look at it, did they use Tyndale and the other guys who they're criticizing?
Yes.
Yes, they did. More on that later, probably not today, but next time or in the future. The preface treats of 3 points. Number one, of the translation of the Holy Scriptures into the vulgar tongues, and namely into English. So you can see that here. Of the translation of the Holy Scriptures into vulgar tongues, and namely English. So that's the first thing they're going to explain. Number two, of the causes why this New Testament is translated into the ancient, is translated according, excuse me, to the ancient vulgar Latin text. So that would be this part. Of the causes why. Now notice this. You see how that looks like two V's?
Yeah.
I can't remember. Did I talk about this later in the notes? You guys read them already, but I don't remember. They were running short on W's.
Oh.
And the reason they were running short on W's is because this is being printed in France, and the W is not a character that shows up very much in French. So they use double B's. Where'd that go?
New and Y.
Right here?
Yeah.
So it's they have no choice but to typeset that as a double B for a W. Because they're printing it in France and they don't have enough W's to do it. So when you see that in here, that's why they're doing it. All right, so where were we at? Oh, and then the third point is on the matter of translating the same. So the preface opens with a statement about why only the New Testament was presented in 1580, in the 1582 printing. They say, quote, so this is quoting from the preface here. And again, I've tried to update much of the spelling as I could. So the Holy Bible, long since translated by us into English, and the Old Testament laying by us for lack of good means to publish the whole in such part as a work of so great charge and importance required. So what are they saying? They're saying they don't have what? They don't have the money to print the whole what? To print the whole thing. So they're only going to do which part? The New Testament, okay? We have yet, through God's goodness at length, fully finished for thee, most Christian reader, all the New Testament, which is the principal, most profitable, and comfortable piece of Holy Writ, and as well as for all other institutions of life and doctrine, especially for deciding the doubts of these days, more proper and pregnant than the other part, not yet what? Printed. So what are they saying here? They're saying, look, we don't have enough money to print this whole thing. But we do have enough money to print what?
New Testament.
And this is the most important thing you need to know right now, so this is why we're going to give you this. Now, like I've already alluded to, eventually, do they also print the Old Testament like over 20 years later? Okay. From Douai, France. So, from this we can deduce the following according to Condon. Quote, from the preface we learn that when the New Testament was published, the whole Bible had been long since translated. The Old Testament had been set aside for lack of means to publish it, and the preference given to the New Testament as the, quote, principal, most profitable, and comfortable piece of Holy Writ. So, if, you know, listen, I would have to say, that, I mean, did William Tyndale do the same thing? Did he print a New Testament and we'll have to wait until he had the Old Testament finished? So, and I'm not by any means comparing these guys to William Tyndale. I'm just saying if you have a limited amount of money and you can only do what you can do, it would make sense to print the New Testament first. Okay? So, as we have seen in prior lessons, since the time of Wycliffe in the late 14th century, the Roman Catholic Church had opposed the English Bible with all its might. So why, after nearly 200 years of opposition and oppression, would the Catholic Church suddenly support an English translation in the late 16th century? I mean, that's a good question, right? I mean, remember they were so mad at Wycliffe, they dug up his dead body, burned it, and threw the ashes in the river. They were so ticked at him, right? Remember we talked about that? They execute William Tyndale. They have opposed the English Bible with all their power and might up to this point, and now all of a sudden they're saying, here's an English Bible. So why the switch? Why the change? Okay, look at the next quote. For 200 years, the papacy has manifested an unchangeable spirit of hatred toward the English Bible. What therefore could have been the motive at this time of these translators in putting forth the scriptures in English? The answer to this otherwise difficult question is found in the preface to the Rheims New Testament, in which they frankly say that it is not for an... So here, I've updated the spelling here again. So this is a quotation from the preface. Erroneous opinion of necessity that the Holy Scriptures... So it is not for an erroneous opinion of necessity that the Holy Scriptures should always be in the mother tongue. So what does that mean? They don't need to what? They don't need to be in English. Okay? Or that they ought. So they don't need to be in English and they don't have to be in what? English. Or were ordained by God to be read indifferently of all, or could be early understood of everyone that readeth or heareth them in a known language. So what are they saying? They're saying most people are too dumb and stupid and uneducated to really be able to what? Read and understand these. So therefore, God's not obligated. He didn't have to do it. So we, by our good graces here, are going to what? Present it to you in English. Okay? So, or that they were not often through man's malice or infirmity pernicious and much hurtful to many. So, the scriptures have hurt people. That's what they're saying. They've harmed them, they've been malicious, and they've been hurtful to many. Or, that we generally or absolutely deemed it more convenient in itself and more agreeable to God's word and honor or edification of the faith to have them turned into the vulgar tongues. So do you get the idea that they're just, you know, really excited to do this? Is that the idea you get? No. The idea you get is that they're doing it, but they don't really what? They don't really want to be doing this. Okay? So, or edification of faith to have been turned into vulgar tongues, then to be kept and studied in the ecclesiastical learned languages. Not for thee or any such like causes do we translate this sacred book, but upon special consideration, watch, of the present time, state, and condition of our country, unto which diverse things are either necessary or profitable or medicinable now, that otherwise in the peace of the church were neither much requisite nor perchance holy what? So in other words, if this set of circumstances didn't exist, we would not be what? We would not be doing this. That's what they're saying. So I'll say it again. Are they doing this with just, you know, great joy to give the English people the word of God? Or are they doing this kicking and screaming because politically they have to? Yeah, it's definitely the latter. From this open confession, it seems that this version grew out of the necessity of the times. That it was a war measure resolved upon in self-defense. So in other words, is there a religious war going on for the hearts and minds of the English people?
Yes.
Yes. And if we don't do this, we will lose. So we're going to do it. We don't really want to do it. But here it is kind of the concept here, right? By episcopal authority of the Church of England, the Bible was now placed in the churches, and by the desire of the people, it is welcomed in the family circle and the individual closet. Yea, the Word of God is entrenched in the hearts of the people, and to drive it out, old methods must be laid aside and new methods what? Now, is there a tactical change in the strategy of the Catholic Church?
Yes.
And you might say, just maybe, that the adversary has something to do with this. Maybe. I mean, I would say that. Maybe some of you wouldn't. But so, what have they done for 200 years? Arrested the possessors of the Bible, burned the Bible, banned the presses. They've done all this stuff to try to keep the English Bible from the people. And now, is the English Bible everywhere? Yes, the English Protestant Bible is everywhere, whether it's in the bishops or the Geneva. It's read out loud at church. People have one in their home. It's discussed at the family table. They're either reading it by themselves in their closet, to use their terminology that they use here. And so now, are they going to have a strategic change in what they're going to do? So instead of banning it, burning it, and all that, now they're going to have to present their own what? Their own version of it.
When they were banning and burning, was that in France or Europe, or was that in England as well?
All the above.
Oh, really?
So plan A didn't work, so now we're going to do plan B.
Plan A didn't work, so now we're going to go to plan B. Okay? That's probably a fair way to say it. So, lost my spot then.
When they talk about vulgar languages, did the priests speak in Latin in the church?
Oh, yeah.
So there wasn't even English spoken.
The Catholic Church did not start doing the Mass in the vernacular until the Vatican II Council in the middle of the 1900s.
That's what I was thinking.
Up through that whole time, it was all done in what?
Latin.
Latin. So unless you knew Latin, you had no clue what the priest was what?
Saying.
So where are we? So yea, the word of God is entrenched in the hearts of the people, and to drive it out, old methods must be laid aside and new methods adopted. Having learned, by observation at least, the power of the English Bible, the papists would resort to the same weapon to defend themselves, and if possible, to inflict a deadly blow upon their foes. English Catholics were reading heretical Bibles, which the hierarchy denounced as, quote, profane translations. To remedy this, the Reims version was published with the express hope that it would prove the occasion of these Catholics putting away the, quote, impure versions as hitherto you have been forced to occupy or accompany. Accompany. Occupy or accompany, I don't know. Occupy looks better, right?
Yeah.
Besides Rome was hopeful and indefatigable. I don't have no idea what that word means. That's a new word to me. In her efforts to win back England to the papal fold. And prominent means to be used were the founding of the English seminary at Douay for educating English priests and the publishing this Romish Bible with its obscure text and patristical notes. So, again, let me say, my comments earlier about the Reims are not a full endorsement of the Reims, just an observation that the biblical text presented in the Reims, is it better than an NIV? It is better than an NIV. The marginal notes and the stuff I showed you earlier, they're teaching Catholic doctrine. Okay? So I think this is an interesting quote, and it's probably, frankly, a good place to stop given the time. So if you look at the next page, it's further discussion about the about some things related to the preface that we do need to get and that we do need to understand, but there is no prayer that I'm going to get through all of that in 3 minutes. Okay? So, we'll end it there and we'll just make the following observation. Does the adversary respond? I don't have a problem with saying the adversary is responding here to what the Protestants are doing. I know that the denominations of Protestantism still had a lot of problems in terms of their doctrine and what they believed. Okay? But you need to not view what's going on back here totally through the lenses of our current day, right? Were these guys locked in a life and death struggle with papists over these issues in the late 1500s, early 1600s?
Literally.
Okay? So it would be easy for us to say, well, some of these groups didn't go far enough and this and that. And I would agree. I mean, they didn't go far enough in their doctrine, right? And it is going to create problems later on. But the Catholics are going to respond to the availability of the Bible by producing their own one. Their own Bible with their own notes and their own notations and textual, so on and so forth. And that's what's happening with the Reams. Now, here's the problem. Does the Reams work in supplanting the Protestant Bibles? The answer to that is no. So you could argue then that are they going to have yet a third strategy that's going to completely do away with the text basis of the Reformation and replace it with a wholly different thing, which would be the critical text. Okay? Here's the thing people don't get. When Westcott and Hort printed their Greek New Testament in 1881, it is a text that no member of the body of Christ had ever seen a day in their life, much less used. And yet they are able to foist it upon the believing church as though it is the original text. There's a massive amount of deception going on there. Plan A, ban it and burn it. Plan B, we'll present our own what?
Version.
Our own version of it. When that doesn't work, then we gotta undermine the underpinning of the Reformation by calling into question the fundamental nature about what the Bible is. If there's one thing the Protestants had right, it was that the Scripture is the final authority, not the church hierarchy. Okay? And I just did two videos this week. For those of you that haven't seen the two videos I did on YouTube this past week, I did two videos. I did one video on why preservation matters, and then I did a second video on the origin of the originals only view. The origin of the originals only view goes back to a Roman Catholic priest named Richard Simon, who says that the Protestant principle regarding the Bible cannot be trusted because the first originals were what? Lost. The idea that inspiration and infallibility should only be confined to the original autographs is first deposited into the thought stream by a Roman Catholic monk in the 1680s. And then 200 years later, it flowers into a complete rewriting of Protestant bibliology and understanding of what the Bible is. If you haven't watched those two videos on YouTube, I encourage you to do that. So they're there. I posted them on Thursday and Friday of this past week. Okay. But we are past time. We have to quit. Does anybody have any? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to cut these notes off, and then I'm going to take everything from page 6 down and pour them over into next week's, and we'll finish this point next week, and then we'll see how much time we have left. Okay? Any questions or comments?
On page 5, in the preface, it says, the Holy Bible long since translated by us into English. They didn't translate it by English. They killed the guy that did it.
I think what they mean to say is, we've had our own translation for a while. We just haven't what? We just haven't printed it. That's the way I understand the statement.
It makes it sound like they're.
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah.
It's a questionable statement. I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
Totally agree with you. All right, we got to quit. If anybody has any questions, I'll take them off camera. But we got to stop the live stream.